Dale, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. I guess I'm going to have to just ask you to give us a call because it doesn't look like our regularly scheduled guest is going to be with us. And in that event, we're going to have a whole hour of open lines. Ordinarily, of course, we would have had Ken Timmerman talking about his book, Countdown to Crisis. And it's a fascinating book. I talked to him earlier today on a different network. And so I'm going to just give you sort of a summary of what Ken Timmerman says. First of all, you have to know a little bit about Ken. I've interviewed him a number of times on various books that he's written. And I interviewed him when he worked for Insight Magazine. Now, Insight Magazine was, I believe, one of the two best conservative magazines in the country. On many issues, it was the best conservative magazine, but because it told the truth. Of course, that is not allowed in America today, and somebody put pressure on the advertisers, and they pulled the advertisement, and the magazine had to shut down. So Ken Timmerman then went off on his own doing investigative reporting, traveling around the world, writing books, and I'd say he's done an excellent job on several books he's written. The latest one, Countdown to Crisis, talks about the coming war with Iran. And has a lot of amazing material in it, which I wish he was here to share with you. But if he's not, we'll go ahead and try to just to give you the background on this. But Ken has contacted people who have come out of Iran. Now, we hear a lot of talk about Osama bin Laden hiding somewhere in the hills of Pakistan. Now, I want you to know, ladies and gentlemen, we have satellites that can read a newspaper from outer space. We have satellites that can track anyone in this world. We monitor every email, every fax, every telephone conversation, every radio conversation in one way or another through computers, and they have voice recognition technology. We have the most amazing technology in the world. We can send a space probe to Mars and drive those little vehicles around on Mars and get the pictures back here. I mean, it's amazing what they can do with technology, and our leaders are not bumbling idiots. They were monitoring the Al-Qaeda movement here in the United States, and the first pictures we have of that was back in 1988 when Abdullah Azzam was giving talks. He headed Al-Qaeda in 1988, the organization that we had created, our CIA had created, and if you doubt that, you really need to get the book entitled Unholy Wars. It was written in 1999, at least 2 years before the 9/11 attack, and you'll find out how the CIA was involved in funding this whole radical Islamic movement. And here was Abdullah Azzam, and you can see the pictures the FBI shot of that in a video we carry entitled Jihad in America. And there was Abdullah Azzam, leader of Al-Qaeda, calling for bloodshed in America, being photographed by the FBI in 1988. And yet we're told the FBI just had no idea what was going on. They have other pictures in 1989 of the man who replaced Azzam here in the United States. They have pictures of the people who blew up the World Trade Center in 1993 at a terrorist training camp in 1989. And they want us to believe they had no idea what was happening. We're going to be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and basically, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call. Our guest is obviously not going to be here. It's going to be a long hour because I have nothing prepared. But our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. One of the most amazing videos is Jihad in America. It was put together by Stephen Emerson based upon footage that he was able to get from the FBI and interviews he did with people from the FBI in 1993 and 1994. And the video was shown one time on PBS, Public Broadcasting System Television, in 1994, and then orders were given. It was never to be shown again. Now, who could give orders and suppress a video in the United States? Well, I suspect the same people who pulled all the references to Willie Brown, Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco, knowing about the 9/11 attack. Before the 9/11 attack, and we know that's true because I actually personally talked to his press secretary who confirmed the story, but all the articles were pulled out of the San Francisco Chronicle. They appeared only in the early morning edition, and then they all disappeared. And then following that, why there was put up on the Internet, because San Francisco Chronicle posts all of its articles on the Internet except that article. And somebody was powerful enough to prevent that article from going up. That may not be the CIA. We have about 12 or 14 intelligence agencies. Any one of those could be involved in suppressing the information and getting the Chronicle to pull the article from future editions of the paper on the 12th of September and pulling the article down off the Internet. And after all, if you can't find the article, then maybe it isn't true. And I suspect it was a similar agency, whoever it was. You must understand, the CIA is not the most powerful intelligence organization. The most powerful intelligence agency is the NSA, the National Security Agency, or affectionately known as NS, the No Such Agency. But we do know that somebody gave orders, and that video, Jihad in America, was never shown after the one showing in 1994 until after the 9/11 attack. And the reason it cannot be shown is it shows that the FBI was in complete and total control of the Islamic terrorist movement. They knew who the Islamic terrorists were here in the United States. And we do know from many, many sources this is true. Zacharias Moussaoui, who was the so-called 20th terrorist, the 20th hijacker, had said, "I was tracked by intelligence agencies from the moment I landed in this country." And we know, of course, he was in contact with Nicholas Berg. You remember the fellow was hit, decapitated over there in Iraq? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and a regularly scheduled guest is not available, so I'm going to ask if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to call in. This is going to be an open lines hour. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And before we went to the break, I was simply pointing out that there is a video, and we have it available now, although I had a terrible time getting it. It was called Jihad in America. It was put together by Stephen Emerson in 1993 after the first World Trade Center bombing. It has there film footage, which was shot by the FBI, which the FBI helped to make available to Mr. Emerson. Pictures of Abdullah Azzam, who led al-Qaeda in 1988, talking in Oklahoma City, at the mosque there, calling for jihad in America and blood to run in the streets, and other Islamic leaders calling for blood and violence and destroying the towers of America's financial security, obviously referring to the World Trade Center. All of this was on film footage. You'll see on that a video shot by the FBI. You'll see the pictures of members of the cell, Islamic terrorist cell, that blew up the World Trade Center in 1993, in military training in upstate New York in 1989. So they were watching all of these people. What you must understand is we were monitoring the entire Islamic terrorist movement in the United States, just as they were then monitoring the Islamic terrorist movement in London. They know who all of these people are. And through something known as Echelon, they have the computer ability to monitor every telephone call in the United States, in Great Britain, in Europe, to monitor every email, to monitor every fax, to monitor every financial transaction. Everything is being monitored everywhere in the world. So don't think for 1 minute they did not know who these people were. And as I commented earlier, Zacharias Massoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, has said that he was monitored from the very moment he arrived in the United States. Now, I really believe he's telling the truth, because I know the government has lied about Massoui. I know several things about Massoui personally. First of all, he was in contact with a man named Nicholas Berg, and that was, of course, sometime before the 9/11 hijacking. But you have to understand who Nicholas Berg was. Nicholas Berg was obviously a government agent of some sort. And Nicholas Berg encountered Zacharias Massoui in Norman, Oklahoma, where Massoui was taking flight training at the Airman Flight School. And Nicholas Berg, for somehow or other, what the relationship was, we don't know, but we know that they exchanged passwords for the computer. And whether it was Nicholas Berg's computer or Massoui's computer, I think it was probably Massoui's computer, but Nicholas Berg had the password to that. Under any circumstances, Nicholas Berg then suddenly goes over to Iraq. And he is traveling around Iraq in the middle of the fighting and the violence and the war going over there for about a year, and we're told he's selling cell phones. Now, how many people in Iraq do you think are going to be buying cell phones in the middle of a war? And obviously, he's there under the auspices of one of our intelligence agencies. That's about all we can say. We know he was picked up by the Iraqi police. He was turned over to the American police. And they claim that they released him. And very shortly thereafter, on television, we see a picture of Nicholas Berg, who's been in contact with Zacharias Massoui. Nicholas Berg on television in a U.S. Government issued or military issued orange jumpsuit, prisoner jumpsuit, the kind that they put all of the prisoners in. And there's Nicholas Berg in this orange military issue jumpsuit, surrounded by so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists, and they're wearing their masks, and supposedly they're about to behead him. Now, I wonder if you're out there in the listening audience, if you think back in your memory, do you remember those pictures? Well, I'm sure many of you probably do. How many of you honestly believe that the Al-Qaeda terrorist movement over in Iraq carries around a U.S. Army issued orange jumpsuits to put their military prisoners in, the Americans they capture? Are we ready to believe that? Do they think the American people are that naive? Well, maybe it is. Maybe they did have a U.S. issued orange jumpsuit. It's interesting that they haven't put any of the other prisoners in that, just Nicholas Berg prior to his beheading. Or is it possible Nicholas Berg knew too much, and his association with Zacharias Massoui might trigger something in the minds of the American people? Well, what else do we know about Zacharias Massoui? Well, after the 9/11 attack, I personally contacted the woman who ran the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma. And she told me that about 10 days before the 9/11 attack, FBI agents had come to her and asked about Zacharias Massoui. And Zacharias Massoui had gone to the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma, and he was such a terrible student, he couldn't even learn how to fly a single engine plane, a one-wing plane. And they'd worked with him and worked with him, and they finally just told him, I mean, you're incapable of flying an airplane. And it was after that that he left and went up to Minneapolis, where, of course, he was, we're told, that he went to the flight school and said he just wanted to learn how to fly a 747. He didn't want to know how to take it off or how to land it. He just wanted to learn how to fly it. And it was pretty obvious to the people there that he was a terrorist and he wanted to know how to crash the 747 into a building. They reported him to the FBI. Now, we are told that, the office in Minneapolis had reported this to headquarters in Washington, D.C., FBI headquarters, and there was also a memo, the so-called Phoenix memo, from the agent in Phoenix, saying that they were very worried that there were an awful lot of Islamic people who were learning to fly here, and that the man in Phoenix was concerned they might be a terrorist learning how to fly planes, because certainly a plane is an excellent weapon to crash into things. But we're told the people in Washington, D.C. just couldn't connect the dots. How many times did you hear that? They couldn't connect the dots. They couldn't put any credence in the relationship between the Phoenix memo and the fact that Zacharias Moussaoui was being held up in Minneapolis, and the people in Minneapolis, the FBI agents there, wanted to search his computer. They wanted to get into his laptop computer and see if there was evidence there about some sort of a terrorist attack. But the people in Washington, D.C., refuse to allow them to look in his computer. Now, all you have to do is simply ask, and you can get an automatic, almost virtually automatic warrant to do anything you want to in the name of fighting terrorism. But prior to 9/11, the FBI refused to do any of the logical things. But we're told that they never connected what was happening in Minneapolis to the terrorist threat of flying planes into buildings. We are told that over and over again. They didn't connect the dots, and they're simply lying. Because at least unless the woman who runs the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma, was lying to me, they were checking on him at least 10 days before the 9/11 attack. So the FBI was tracking Moussaoui long before the 9/11 attack, but they don't want the American people to know that. Furthermore, the woman who ran the flight school told me that she had actually also been contacted immediately after the 9/11 attack, a week to 10 days, by the FBI, asking about a man named Muhammad Atta. And they told her that he had attended her flight school. Well, she didn't even remember Muhammad Atta, but she went through her records, and sure enough, he'd been there. And he had actually looked around and she'd taken a record of him. He'd filled out an application, but never done anything with it at all. She didn't even remember him, but the FBI knew all about him. They knew where he'd stayed, how long he was there. They knew all the details of what Muhammad Atta had done when he was in Norman, Oklahoma, before the 9/11 attack. And this was sometime probably 6 months ahead of time. And yet, immediately after the attack, they knew all about him. In fact, the most amazing thing, we are, to be honest, want the American people to believe that the bumbling FBI that had no idea what was happening, had no idea who any of the terrorists were, had no idea that the attack was coming. Within 24 hours, they knew the names of all of the hijackers. They knew, had a rundown on them. They had pictures of all of them. Isn't that the most amazing thing? In fact, I've talked to Daniel Hopsiger, who talked to a man at Huffman Aviation in Venice, Florida. And that man told him within 4 hours of the attack why FBI agents were in front of his house asking him about Muhammad Atta. And, of course, later that day or early the following morning, they were at Huffman Aviation picking up all of the records from Huffman Aviation. And you begin saying, well, how can this totally incompetent organization suddenly become so efficient? And I would like to suggest we have the most effective intelligence organizations in the entire world, right here in the United States. They are tracking everybody. They have dossiers on most people. They have pictures of them. I mean, so often you'll watch these detective programs on, and you'll find out that they will go to their computer and they'll put in somebody's name, and lo and behold, they've got their picture, and they've got all sorts of information on them. And they are collecting dossiers on everybody in the United States today. Now, what's so interesting, if you read the staff report of the 9/11 Commission, there's a lot of information there. It's obvious that we were tracking Muhammad Atta while he was right here in the United States. We know that they were tracking him when he was overseas. Why would we think that they stopped tracking Muhammad Atta when he got back to the United States? They tracked him when he went to Spain earlier in 2001. They tracked him when he was in Germany and the Germans were tracking him. And actually, according to the staff report of the 9/11 Commission, we have this, if you want to challenge it, why they have pictures of Muhammad Atta at an ATM machine in February and March of the year 2001, what, 6 or 7 months before the 9/11 attack, taking money out of an ATM machine in the United States on the East Coast there. How did they get those pictures? Did anybody ever stop and ask? But most people don't want to stop and ask anything. Because, of course, sometimes the answers are too painful. When we get back, please give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and unfortunately, our regularly scheduled guest didn't show up. We were planning on having a 30-minute of open lines, and, well, lines are open. If you'd like to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest this evening was to have been Kenneth Timmerman on his book, entitled Countdown to Crisis. And basically, this is the story of the coming war with Iran. And according to Kenneth, there's no question at all that we are going to soon to be at war with Iran. And of course, without all the terrible complications that are going to develop because of the close relationship that exists between Iran and Russia, Iran and India, Iran and Pakistan, and Iran and communist China. So if we do get into a war with Iran, it's going, of course, I believe, to put us in opposition to so many other countries in this world, and yet everything seems to be in place for the coming war with Iran. And one of the things that Kenneth Timmerman brings out in his book, entitled A Countdown to Crisis, is the fact that Osama bin Laden has been seen on a number of occasions in Iran. Now, this is not surprising to me because I've heard this story from other people who have in touch with intelligence agencies or with people who've come out of Iran. And it is well known throughout the rest of the world that Osama bin Laden is in Iran. In fact, recently, Portagas, who is the chairman of the Central Intelligence Agency, Portagas was asked, "Do you know where Osama bin Laden is?" And he replied, "Yes." Next question. And then somebody asked him, "Well, where is he and why don't you get him?" "Oh, well, there are all sorts of complications and national sovereignty and you don't want to be too aggressive and let's get on to another question." Obviously, they know where Osama bin Laden is. They just don't want the American people to know where Osama bin Laden is. Which takes us to this whole incredible story of why we have never tried to get Osama bin Laden. Well, we know that he worked with the CIA. The CIA denies this, but there's so much information out there that he worked with the CIA all during the 1980s, during the Soviet War. And his organization was funded, and his people were trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. But how can the government admit that they created the Al-Qaeda movement? We know from John Cooley's book, Unholy Wars. And John Cooley was a reporter from the Christian Science Monitor, and in 1999 he wrote his book Unholy Wars, and he was talking about how the CIA was distributing copies of the Quran to the Mujahideen, the holy warriors in Afghanistan, encouraging him in this radical form of Islam, which had been dormant, had not existed for already so many years. And suddenly, the FBI, the CIA, and our intelligence agencies are doing everything they can to actually awaken this slumbering giant, this slumbering monster of Al-Qaeda, of radical Islam. USAID, United States Agency for International Development, spends $51 million on textbooks to be used in Afghan schools to train the youth in radical form of Islam and killing the infidels. And ladies and gentlemen, you and I are the infidels. And if you'd like to document that, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the article on the ABCs of Jihad. The ABCs of Jihad comes out of the Washington Post. Excellent article, quoted in many places. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is not here. So if you would like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So we have just got our producer. We don't have our guest as yet, and so it's going to be just you and me. But give me a call of 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'll develop these ideas a lot further. The fact that the Al-Qaeda movement was financed and encouraged at every turn by U.S. intelligence agencies as we moved to create the best enemy that money could buy. And, of course, in 1979, the United States CIA toppled the Shah of Iran and bought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. I know this to be the case, and I can remember so vividly it happening at that time, and the CIA did everything they could to destabilize the Ayatollah Khomeini, the Shah's regime, and then ordered him to leave the country, which he did, of course. And, of course, getting an order from the American government is like getting an order from the mafia. It's a order you can't decline. And so the Shah left the country, which automatically brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. And this is exactly what happened in Cuba when the United States State Department told Batista he would leave the following day. And as a result of that, of course, Fidel Castro came to power. Most people do not understand. We brought Fidel Castro to power in Cuba in 1959. How do I know that? Because I interviewed William Sullivan. Pardon me, I interviewed Earl Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at that time, and he told me how he was ordered by the State Department in December of 1958 to go to Batista, President Batista, and tell him he would leave the country within 48 hours, which of course he did, and he was allowed at least to get out alive. If it stayed, I'm sure that we would have sent the CIA in to kill him, and he knew that. We'd done everything we could to destabilize him. The State Department knew Fidel Castro was a communist and brought him to power. Now, if you want to the written story, why it is in Ambassador Smith's book, The Fourth Floor, and we'll very, very soon have an interview where you will actually see my interview with Ambassador Smith, where he tells the story I've just told you. If that is indeed true, why doesn't every American know it? And the answer is very simply, because the media here is controlled. Well, we did the same thing with the Shah. We toppled the Shah of Iran. We brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in 1979. And I can remember at that time thinking, why would we possibly toppled the Shah of Iran, who was our friend, who had the sixth largest army in the world, who was certainly the American bulwark against the Soviet Union in the Middle East. Why would he topple a friend and bring an enemy to power? And in 1979, it didn't make any sense. It makes a lot of sense today. The old adage, we created the best enemy money could buy, and laid the foundation for the whole Islamic terrorist movement, and for World War III, which we're moving into. Well, of course, Kenneth Timmerman doesn't cover any of these things in his book, Countdown to Crisis, but he does say that we're going to war with Iran. It's very, very obvious that preparations are being made for that. We have our spies in there. We're trying to destabilize the government. And if we cannot overthrow the government, by subversion, then, of course, we are going to attack. And the interesting thing is, Kenneth Timmerman's book talks about Osama bin Laden, that Osama bin Laden was actually there, that he's well known, that Osama bin Laden, who's really very ill, he's not living in a cave in Pakistan, he's living in Iran, and his son is there, has been there for a long period of time. And Osama bin Laden is in Iran, and of course is working with the Iranians, who are in large part financing, they, along with our good friends the Saudis and our good friends in Syria, are financing the insurgents who are killing our men in Iraq. Why aren't we doing anything about the Syrians and the Saudis and the Iranians financing the insurgents? Why, very simply, because if we had a peaceful Iraq, how could we possibly justify staying there? As long as there is crisis and chaos in Iraq, we can always say, well, we can't leave. Why, everybody who's died there would have died for nothing. We've just got to stay there and continue losing more boys, because, after all, we want to bring democracy to Iraq. Isn't that what the war was all about? Or was it about the fact that they had weapons of mass destruction? Or was it because Saddam was about to attack the United States? We had to do something. Well, right now it looks like we have Kenneth Timmerman coming on the line, and so they will find he has a great deal more information than we do, and you'll be fascinated talking to him. So we'll be back here in just a moment with Kenneth Timmerman talking about his book, Countdown to Crisis. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we have Kenneth Timmerman on the line. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you again.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I apologize this morning for forgetting the name of your book, but Countdown to Crisis is a fascinating book, and certainly you've been in touch with a lot of people who've actually been over there and given you information about what's really going on in Iran. So why don't you sort of fill in some of the details for our listeners?
Well, the real main point that I think everybody needs to remember is that the Islamic Republic of Iran today is a terrorist state which has become a virtual nuclear weapon state. So you put those two things together, which President Bush has been warning about, and you've got a clear and present danger for the United States. I track in the book Iran's terrorist record. This revolution began in 1979 with the taking, obviously, of U.S. hostages in Tehran and our embassy. But most people think they got out of the terror business when they delivered the hostages back to us when President Reagan took over in January of 1981. And that's simply not true. And I go through their terrorist record, and you can see that the Islamic Republic continued to kill Americans in Beirut. In 1983, they killed 241 of our Marines when they blew up the barracks there, and they killed our people again in Saudi Arabia in 1996 in Tehran, and they're killing our people today in Iraq by their assistance to the Iraqi insurgency. So when you put together that terrorist regime with a nuclear weapons capability, you have a clear and present danger, and the kind of thing that the United States simply can't allow to exist.
And I certainly agree with you. One of the interesting things you brought out is the fact that Osama bin Laden has been seen in Iran. Now, we're repeatedly told he's over there in Pakistan hiding in a cave, and I've heard the same story you have from other people. What's the source of your information, can you tell us? And what are the implications of Osama bin Laden working with the Iranian terrorist regime?
Sure. The source of the information that bin Laden is currently in Iran comes actually from eyewitness reports, which I have received from people inside Iran who were physically present at meetings between Osama bin Laden and senior Iranian government leaders. And this was in, there are two meetings in particular. One was in November of 2004. And then there was a follow-on meeting in March of 2005.
Hold that thought there for just a minute as we bring our other stations back on board. And I think you'll really enjoy Kenneth Timmerman's remarks as he talks about his new book, Countdown to Crisis. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Kenneth Timmerman is on the line, and his book, A Countdown to Crisis, a fascinating insight into the real threat from Iran. Now, and he was just telling us that there have been a number of the first-hand reports of people who had attended meetings, and we're talking about last year and again on this year, between Osama bin Laden and leaders of the revolutionary regime there in Iran. Would you mind repeating that? Because all of our stations now are back with us.
Well, it's very significant. The U.S. has said repeatedly, U.S. officials have said repeatedly that bin Laden is probably somewhere in Pakistan, maybe in Afghanistan, but they can't find him. What's unusual about that is that both the Pakistani government and the Afghan government would like to find bin Laden because, give you the example of Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, he has been the victim of, or the near victim, of seven assassination attempts by Osama bin Laden. So there's no reason for the Pakistani or the Afghan government to shelter Osama bin Laden. My sources say, and these sources include eyewitnesses who are physically present at meetings between bin Laden and Iranian government officials, that he is currently in Iran. And he's been plotting with Iranian government officials to carry out future terrorist attacks against America and also against American allies. Now, the meeting in November of 2004, Stan, was with they were talking about attacks against U.S. allies in Europe and specifically Great Britain. So there may indeed be a link to the attacks on July the 7th, these recent attacks in Britain that the British authorities believe were carried out by bin Laden's people, Al-Qaeda.
Well, Chris, what's so fascinating is that, although you know this, and we've heard this from other people, the average American has no idea what's really going on over there. And all of our attention is being focused on, Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, but we just can't find him, and all shucks. But if he's in Iran, of course, we're not about to send people in there. That would be an act of overt war.
And it would be very difficult to get the up-to-date intelligence to find him. See, the real problem is not that we knew. You know, the U.S. might have been able to figure out where he was 2 months ago or 4 months ago or 6 months ago. If we're going to send our special forces in there, we need to know where he's going to be tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And that's the hard thing.
Right. Well, anyway, of course, there's some have been Laden there, but then you talk about the regime there in Rafsanjani, who everybody wants to talk about as a moderate, but you point out that Rafsanjani really wasn't a moderate, and of course, the fellow now who's been elected over there is the antithesis of a moderate.
That's correct. The new president who was, I like to say he was selected because there was a selection of candidates before this so-called election a couple of weeks ago. By the clerics, they had over 1,000 candidates. They rejected most of them, and they left 8 in the field. The Iranians say, "Well, we have a more democratic regime than you do in the United States because we had 8 presidential candidates." Well, they forget that there were 1,000 others who were rejected by the regime because they did not accept the clerical dictatorship. Rafsanjani, you mentioned, somebody who's a big figure in my book, Countdown to Crisis, because he was. Deeply involved in the nuclear weapons program in Iran and also deeply involved in their export of terrorism. He personally sat on a committee all during the 1980s and the 1990s that authorized the assassination of over 200 Iranian political dissidents living overseas in Europe primarily, people who had opposed the clerical dictatorship and had gone into exile. Rafsanjani personally was involved in authorizing their murder by hit squads.
And it's difficult, I think, for the average American living in the security of our country to imagine that this sort of thing happens to people from other countries. But, certainly they put the contracts out on other people and snuffed them out. The poor old, what was his name, who wrote the satanic verse. Salman Rushdie. And I don't know whether he's ever actually come out of hiding, but he knew they were going to kill him. They had a contract on him. And how can you live in a world where governments put contracts out on people to kill them? This is not a civilized world. And yet, of course, Iran is welcomed into the family of nations and certainly building very close ties, what concerns me, to Russia and China and Pakistan and Iran and India.
No, that's absolutely correct. And you mentioned Salman Rushdie. He lived for 15 years with day in and day out police protection from the British government because he was the target of a fatwa, religious ruling from Ayatollah Khomeini and then his successors in the Islamic Republic because of a novel he wrote. He wrote a novel, folks. It wasn't that he wasn't a former intelligence agent, he hadn't revealed secrets about the regime. He wrote a novel and they condemned him to death. There are other people, 200 dissidents that the regime has liquidated overseas because they would not accept this notion of clerical dictatorship. The Iranians call it Veliyat-e Fahi. It means the rule of the Islamic jurisprudent, the Islamic judge. It began with Ayatollah Khomeini, and today is being continued with a new guy named Khamenei. But it essentially means clerical dictatorship. Whatever they want goes. The new president, Ahmadinejad, has said very famously, "We didn't have a revolution in Iran to have democracy. That's not why we had a revolution, to bring democracy. We had a revolution to bring Islamic an Islamic regime."
Well, now, in your book, you talk about the bombing of the Marine barracks there in Beirut back in 1983, and you point out that we actually knew who had done that, and the United States did not respond. I mean, that was the most amazing thing. We knew the Iranians had done this, and because they were financing Hezbollah, and we didn't take them to task for it.
It's really quite an incredible story, Stan, and that's why I thought it was worthwhile telling that story again today. There is new information. The new information that I bring in the book is in fact the intercept that the National Security Agency had of communications from Tehran to their embassy in Damascus, Syria, ordering the attack against the U.S. Marines in Beirut. 241 Marines died in that attack in October of 1983. Now, I've investigated this quite extensively. I went to Caspar Weinberger, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time in the Reagan administration, and Mr. Weinberger told me that he was not aware of this. He had never heard of this intercept. He had never received definitive intelligence that showed who was behind the attack on the Marine barracks. And frankly, as I look at this record, I find it a little bit incredible. By the way, the person who was filtering his intelligence at the time was an army general named Colin Powell. And Colin Powell's people tell me that, well, that intercept and that intelligence that the Iranians had ordered the barracks to be bombed in Beirut by their people never made its way up the hierarchy to the political leadership. It's a little bit hard to believe.
I agree with you. In fact, I read Robert Baer's book, See No Evil. He talks about that as well. How could they be that inept unintentionally?
It's hard to say, but you know, we have such a huge government bureaucracy, it's hard almost for it to be efficient because it's so big.
Well, of course, the next thing, what are the implications of a conflict with Iran? I mean, we're having a hard time there in Iraq at the present time. If we get involved with a conflict with Iran, we're opening up a terrible can of worms, aren't we?
Absolutely correct. But at this point, nobody's talking about an open military conflict with Iran. Obviously, the Pentagon is wargaming any kind of contingencies. That's their job. But nobody's talking about a U.S.-launched attack. That's not what the administration is talking about, and nobody that I have consulted in the administration is talking about that. What we're looking at is a terrorist regime that's developing nuclear weapons, okay? And how can the United States impact their behavior through various international organizations to walk back that nuclear weapons program? That's a very difficult proposition. The president has appointed somebody very tough, Jackie Walcott Sanders, and I profile her in my book, to the International Atomic Energy Agency to try to convince our former allies, such as the French and the Germans, to crack down on the Iranians, and they won't do it. There doesn't seem to be an awful lot we can do that will convince the French and the Germans in particular to realize what's going on in Iran and take those steps that would crack down on the nuclear program. So diplomacy seems to be a difficult way to try. We have to take, in my opinion, and this is where I get at the end of the book, we have to take the Iranian regime to the UN Security Council. We have to also provide massive assistance to the pro-democracy forces inside Iran. The problem is the regime. It's not so much the weapons. It is actually this terrorist regime that has the weapons.
Well, of course, this would be like, well, if Iran were to begin to subsidize subversion in the United States, we wouldn't take very kindly approach to that. Is Iran going to take a very kind look if we finance unrest in their country?
That's a good point, and of course they won't. But they already believe that we're doing it, even though we haven't been doing it. I tell a number of stories in the book about these kind of half-hearted attempts during the 1980s and 1990s by the U.S. government to promote regime change in Iran. There's one where former President Nixon was involved with the son of the former Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, the son. And there was a plot in 1986-1987 to bring the former the son of the former Shah back onto an island in the Persian Gulf, and former President Nixon got involved. He was talking to admirals and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other people, military officials, to figure out what naval units and Air Force units had to be deployed to protect a government on a liberated portion of Iranian territory. It's really quite an extraordinary story. So there were other plans which were quite a bit more vigorous than what's being looked at today.
In other words, they were going to set up a parallel government and say, now, of course, we have this government, and we're going to recognize this other government headed by the son of the Shah of Iran.
That's right, on a liberated portion of Iranian territory. And the young Shah, at first, he was thrilled when he looked at me. He said, my goodness, I'm actually going to become king. And then as he went through the details of the plan, now, remind our listeners, this was during the Iran-Iraq War. This was a shooting war, okay, in the Persian Gulf, and as when the Iraqis shot the USS Stark and killed 37 U.S. Navy personnel on board that ship. The Iranians were planting mines in the Strait of Hormuz to sink oil tankers. This was the big shooting war in the 1980s. So the son of the Shah, he looks at this and ultimately he says, he turns to the guy who brought him the plans from Richard Nixon, and he says, how do I get out of here if this all goes bad?
And, of course, there wouldn't be any way really to be sure that you would get out. That would be the problem.
No, that's true. That is true. A big, big shooting war, and he wasn't sure that the F-14s and the U.S. warships would be able to protect him.
And, of course, in 1986, that was the middle of the Iran-Iraqi war, and we were actually doing everything we could to back Iraq, embargoing weapons to Iran. And then, of course, we suddenly started providing weapons for Iran. So we were providing weapons to Iraq, we were providing weapons to Iran, and they were killing one another's troops.
Well, if I were to be cynical, Stan, I'd say we tore a page out of the French book. The French were doing that, the Russians, the Soviets at the time were doing the same thing, the Chinese were as well. I wrote an earlier book many, many years ago about that particular war, the Iran-Iraq War, and as I recall now, there were 37 countries that were supplying both sides, Iran and Iraq, with weaponry.
And what a really terrible commentary that is on morality.
Well, it really is. it certainly is. And there was a lot of money made during that war.
Yeah, but of course there was an awful lot of suffering, and probably half a million people died. Well, let's go to Daryl, who's calling us in from Pennsylvania. Hi, Daryl, and we will open up for other questions if people would like to call in. Daryl, did you have a question or comment?
I do have two questions for Mr. Timmerman, and I just came in kind of late on the show, but can I ask, number one, Mr. Timmerman, are you advocating in your book regime change in Iran because they are a, quote, terrorist regime?
Right. Go ahead.
Yes, and what I say, Daryl, is that the problem is not even Iran's nuclear weapons capability. It is the fact of a terrorist regime possessing nuclear weapons, and we do have an asset inside Iran, which is a tremendous pro-democracy force. The young people of Iran who rejected this regime, I think, quite decisively, but they need some help.
Well, my follow-on question would be then, using that same measuring tool or device on Russia and Red China, who have been two of the greatest supporters of terrorism in the past 4 to 5 decades, or shouldn't we advocate regime change there also?
Good point. A good point and tough question. In communist China, it's a little bit clearer than in Russia. Russia, there has been a regime change. Obviously, there's no longer the Soviet Union. Now, you could argue that Putin has just brought a KGB regime in, but it's not as clear as all that. In communist China, you still have communism, and you still have state control, and you do not have any kind of challenge to that regime. And now they're threatening Taiwan with military force and a military takeover, and they have engaged in a pretty massive military buildup, which I've been reporting on for about 10 years. I did a bunch of stories in the American Spectator in the 1990s about this. And the Clinton sell-off of U.S. National security technology to communist China. It's very serious. It's getting worse, and it's not going to get better.
We're in real trouble, Daryl, as you well know, because I know you listen to our programs regularly. Anything else you wanted to ask our guest?
No, I worked 26 years in the intelligence community, and certainly the biggest supporter was the former Soviet Union, and I would maintain with some of the folks, the missionaries that I know have been over there, there was very little change. The top communists remained in a lot of the key power positions, especially military, security forces and that, so I don't think there was much of a change here. Well, God bless you, Dr.
Thanks so much, Daryl, but I think the really significant thing is they no longer call themselves communists. Now they call themselves socialists or something like that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Drew, we've got Mr. Timmerman with us a few more minutes, so when we get back, we'll ask. I don't think we can really take any more calls, but Ken, as you look at this, do you think the United Nations is going to be able to make a difference if we do bring them before the United Nations?
I don't have a great deal of confidence in the United Nations, but I think we have to go that route. We did it with Saddam Hussein for 12 years. We had 17 UN Security Council resolutions. We've got to start.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here. And just we'll keep you 3 more minutes. We'll let you go.
Sure.
Well, I guess this evening is Mr. Ken Timmerman, his book, Countdown to Crisis, excellent book. A lot of great information, a lot of great history there. We've got Ray calling from Santa Cruz. Ray, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. I have 2 questions.
Just take one, because we've only got time for
One question. Now, what are the possibilities of capturing Osama? And what if he dies, and who would take over then?
Well, if he dies, we're very happy, aren't we?
Yeah, right. Who would take over?
Capturing him is a question of having actionable intelligence. In other words, we need to know where he's going to be tomorrow morning at 9:03, okay, or 2:15 in the afternoon, exactly where he's going to be, and we have to have our forces there ahead of time. Not an easy thing to do, especially if he is in Iran, which I believe he is. Who's going to take it over in his organization? It's, in a way... maybe 1,000 people will take over, but we kill them one by one. But bin Laden has been the emir, the prince, the leader, the main authority. He's been able to command thousands of people. I'm not sure that anyone else will have that same authority after him.
He's almost a legend. He's almost, you know...
we made him a legend, too.
Oh, that's a question. I have anything else? Got time for one more quick question, Ray?
I find it interesting that 15 of the... the hijackers of 9/11 were Saudis. Born in Saudi Arabia.
Let's get to Ken's remark on that. What about this idea that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, so we attack Afghanistan?
No, but he's absolutely right. 15, they were Saudis, and Saudi Arabia has been a breeding ground for al-Qaeda, and it still is a breeding ground for al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And it's only very recently that the Saudi regime has woken up to this. They have been funding al-Qaeda. They've been funding radical jihadis. Mm-hmm. They have been funding the Wahhabi mosques around the world and these, centers where they're training young people in Pakistan and elsewhere, the schools where they're training people. So Saudi Arabia has been a problem, has not been part of the solution. They've been part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ray, we're going to have to let you go, but thank you so much for calling. And Roger, we're not going to get you this hour. Maybe we can get you next hour. But, Ken, I want to thank you so very much for being our guest. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners, other than they should really get your book and what is available every place?
Certainly in bookstores, also at kentimmerman.com, which is my website, and a lot of articles there, and some excerpts from the book that were in the Washington Times. Iran is the Islamic Republic of Iran is a clear and present danger. You've got a terrorist regime which has become a virtual nuclear weapon state. And this is exactly the kind of threat that the president...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. All right, fine. Well, our guest is Kenneth Timmerman, his book, Countdown to Crisis. And go ahead and finish your thought there, please.
Yeah, a terrorist state that has become a virtual nuclear weapons power is precisely the kind of threat that the president has been warning about. I end Countdown to Crisis with a scenario for what could happen, and in fact, the kind of thing the Pentagon has been wargaming against. Iran gives a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group. Terrorist group puts it on board a tramp steamer off the coast of the United States, hits a U.S. city, kills hundreds of thousands of people, and we don't know the return address. Now, this became a real-time, a real-life scenario in 1998 when the Iranians actually conducted exactly this kind of experiment in the Caspian Sea. So this is not political fiction. This is an actual wargaming scenario that has resulted from an Iranian action. This is the kind of thing that we could see in the future, and this is why Iran is a clear and present danger.
All right. Well, I appreciate so much for being with us, and God bless you. Thanks very much. We'll look forward to your next book.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, I guess it's been Kenneth Timmerman. I hope you've enjoyed our program, and of course, perhaps the opening remarks for the first half hour begin to set the stage for what's taking place. In my estimation, nothing is as it appears to be. We have not tried to get Osama bin Laden. We didn't try to get him before the 9/11 attack. And if you read Richard Miniter's book, Losing Bin Laden, we had at least 11 different times we could have taken Osama bin Laden out. We knew he was responsible for killing Americans in Aden in 1992. We knew he was responsible for working with the First World Trade Center bombing in 1993. We knew he was behind the Black Hawk Down incident in Sudan in 1994, behind the bombing of the Khobar Towers, in 1996. I mean, Osama bin Laden has been involved in all sorts of attacks on America, and our leaders refused to take him out. What was even more uncalled for is that we went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, presumably to get Osama bin Laden, and we weren't allowed to get him. We didn't try to get him, and if any of you doubt that, we have a clipping we'll be glad to send to any of you who give us a call and ask for it. Out of the Washington Times, a high official interviewed saying, "We're not going after Osama bin Laden. If we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war? How would we justify this war?" And that's a rather frightening thing. We carry a book called Crude Politics by Paul Sperry. And he talked to these special forces people who came back from Afghanistan, and they said they weren't allowed to try to get Osama bin Laden. So he has been consistently protected by some element of our government since he first took over leadership in, I guess it was 1989, after, of course, his agents killed Abdullah Azzam. So you have to really understand that nothing is as it appears to be. And if you're looking for logic why you're not going to find it, unfortunately we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought out on a political and ideological battlefield. And my fear is that we're being drawn into World War III, and God is going to use that to bring judgment on America. So with that as a background, of course, we hope many of you will want to get the material that we have on this. You can go to my website and pull down all of the various newsletters we have dealing with our involvement, starting in September of the year 2001, and pull them down. And we are actually going to put them into a series of pamphlets so you can have them and read them and study them. And we have the documentation on everything. We could have taken out Osama bin Laden at any time. We've specifically not tried to. And you have to ask yourself, why? Well, I'd like to suggest that Osama bin Laden is the best possible enemy that American money could buy. We need an enemy to rally the people behind the people who are controlling our government and leading us into World War III. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. And we'll be back in just a moment for the next hour. And for those who are leaving us, why, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295, and we really hope that many of you will begin to challenge so much of what you believe today. I did a fascinating interview this past week with Professor Ball, who was one of the first men ever to get his degree in climatology. He got it in Great Britain, in London many years ago, and he is a scientist and studies all of these things about climate and geology and so much information. Of course, he was really our guest, pointing the fact that this whole idea of global warming is simply a scam. Not that the world isn't warming. It's been warming as we started the warming up phase back in 1683. The contention is not, do we have global warming? Of course we have global warming. The question is man's activity and CO2 have anything to do with the gradual rise in the temperature that began in 1683? And the answer is obviously no. But that really doesn't matter. But one of the things he brought out is that there is enough oil in the oil sands and the oil shale up in Canada to last the world for 100 years. There's enough oil in the oil sand and the oil shale to last the world for 100 years, and at $20 a barrel for oil, why it pays to get it out? Well, the price, of course, is up to $50 or $60 a barrel. And we're not doing anything. In fact, we're letting the Chinese buy up the oil shale in Canada so they can use it for themselves. And we're not trying to solve the problem. There's an organized effort to convince the American people we're running out of oil. And, of course, we're no more dinosaurs. That's why we're running out of oil. If something that foolish, that was what they were telling us back in 1973, as if somehow oil comes from decomposing dinosaurs. And if you believe that, why, you probably believe there's global warming. Be that as it may. The thing is that there is no oil shortage. There is plenty of oil in the oil sands up there. It's simply, we don't want to solve the problem. We need the problem to justify keeping our troops in the Middle East and, of course, continuing to inflame the anger of the Muslims as we draw ourselves into World War III. If you understand that is the major motivation, then it all makes sense. If you're looking for logic, you're not going to find it. And with that as a background, let's go to Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Hi, Andrew. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Well, I'm so glad you could be with us. And why don't you pick up, of course, we're going to be covering the various issues in the latest or last week's News Affairs Brief. Pick up the story.
Okay, Dr. Stan. Well, this week's brief, of course, the major headline news was it was a preliminary analysis about the London bombing. This story has had some recent developments of late. It's sort of refreshing to deal to a certain extent with a group of police forces other than those that are in the United States. Here in the States, we kind of tend to put a lot of trust in the necessary secrecy of the FBI and the CIA and the ATF and all the other police organizations. So when they don't tell us about what they're finding, we just kind of assume that, well, that's necessary for everything to go forward.
Hold that for just a moment. We're going to have to. We'll be right back in just a moment here with Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen. Andrew was saying that here in the United States, why we assume, that if the FBI and the CIA and the ATF don't tell us the truth, why they have, of course, to keep these secrets somehow to keep Osama bin Laden or the criminals or the communists or the mafia. They can't tell us the truth, why, for some reason or other. Anyway, go ahead and pick up the story there.
I think mostly it's just an indication of how much the American public actually buys these stories. In contrast, if you look at what's happening in England right now, I think that the English population in general is a lot more savvy about wanting to know what's really going on, and consequently the Scotland Yard has been a little bit more open about the evidence that they've been accruing in some ways.
Well, one of the things that I was very interested in reading in the World Affairs Brief, that it appears that the explosives were not homegrown or homemade. They were military explosives, and the question is, where did these ragtag turbaned, we assume that, of course, we're told they're Al-Qaeda, but where did these ragtag terrorists get military explosives and the sophisticated technology to be able to explode these? Because it would appear that they really were not suicide bombers. These were sophisticated bombs with some sort of electronic device to set them off.
Yes, and given the timing of the bombings and the magnitude of the bombings, this is definitely no schlock operation. This was well planned and well executed. Some of the most recent developments have been that the Scotland Yard has reported that they found what they think were four men who were responsible, or who were principally responsible for setting off the bomb. They were clued into this because a family reported one of their sons missing, and the police, through investigating that missing, found that he was one of the people on the bus that was exploded, and he was seen at King's Cross Station with three other men just 20 minutes before all of the explosions took place, and they've identified all four of the people, and they say that they have found documents with each person's name in each separate car.
Hold on, we'll be back there in just a moment here with Andrew Skousen.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew was saying that apparently there's been a break in the case in London, and they claim that one of the families of one of the people who were involved in the bombing had reported him missing, and he was supposedly on the bus that exploded, and then they have pictures of him, because they have, of course, video cameras all over London, and they had pictures of him, apparently, meeting with three other Islamic people at one of the places very, very close to the site of this whole bombing, and then you say that they have messages from each one of those men in a car someplace?
No, actually, the four men are, as far as they know right now, of British descent.
British.
So far they've said that they've tracked each one of these four people to the four different bombing sites, each one separately, because of papers and personal artifacts of each one of these people at each one of the bombings. They assume, because of the one who's been reported missing, that at least one of them is dead, and so they assume that at least one of them was a suicide bomber, and they're assuming that all four of them were suicide bombers. Which would be probably the first case of suicide bombings in England or Western Europe.
But were these Muslims of British descent, Muslims who were living in Britain, who had been born there? Were they English people?
Yeah, that part hasn't been made clear by the stories that I've read. It sounds like they aren't Muslims, but it could be Muslims of British descent. all four of them came from an area in Leeds, which has a very large Muslim population, and so it's very possible. I'm not completely sure about that aspect.
Well, this must be very, very recent, because I read the World Affairs brief this morning. That story wasn't up there, so this is a breaking story, huh?
Right. Yeah. This is just brand new today. Some of the inconsistencies that I think are worth noting about this is that, given the scale of these attacks, and as we were just talking about, given the technology of the bombings and the timing, to then have these same people leave personal artifacts with their names and allowing a way to trace them back is a little too good to be true, in my opinion. I think that if these people are smart enough to pull off an attack like this, they're smart enough to take off personal effects before they either blow themselves up or blow up the bag that the personal effects are in. So I think that there are some inconsistencies. It's just a little suspicious about how well this is working out. So it'll be interesting to see where the media takes this story and how they attribute it. Of course, most people who have been watching this story, have been watching the news, think that they've already found that this was an Al Qaeda event. I mean, Al Qaeda has already claimed responsibility for it, right? Well, we need to take a look at that just a little bit closer as well. The so-called attribute to Al Qaeda came from a brief message that occurred on a Muslim website that supposedly often has messages from Al Qaeda on it. I'm not exactly sure how they keep track of these things, but one news agency at least picked up on this message and then spread it out to everyone else. And the message briefly said basically that an up until now unheard of group calling themselves, quote, the secret group of Al-Qaeda's jihad in Europe claimed responsibility.
And nobody's ever heard of the secret group of Al-Qaeda in Europe.
Right. No one's ever heard of it. And this is sort of semantics, but the title of the group smacks of being made up, in my opinion. If there truly are a lot of subsets of Al Qaeda throughout the world, because we've broken up the core of it in Pakistan and Afghanistan, then these groups are supposedly well established throughout different areas of the world in finance and have all these arms, and yet this one group that nobody's ever heard of suddenly comes up with this message calling themselves a sort of funky name that sounds like it's right out of a President Bush press bulletin, and decides to take credit for it very briefly, and then before anyone can actually analyze the message, it's quickly taken down, and that's all we hear about them.
It sounds a little fishy, doesn't it?
Like, yeah.
Maybe this comes from a B-rate movie.
It does, exactly. It smacks of a B-rated movie. So the attribute to Al-Qaeda is not concrete. The fact that these four people were, there's a parts of the story that make it sort of fishy and a little too good to be true, puts a little bit of suspicion on it as well.
Well, I think we can only look back on November 11th, and of course the government gave us the names of 19 hijackers who were all killed during the attack. The only trouble is that Inside Magazine tracked down six of them were alive and well, living over in the Middle East. Now, of course, we could say, well, maybe they stole their identity and they were pretending to be these people. But, you know, there's something very wrong with that entire story, especially because somebody then put such pressure on the advertisers for Inside Magazine, they had to close down the magazine that dared to challenge the official government story and found that six of the people were alive. And we have that article from Inside Magazine, you know, so, and you could probably even find it up on the Internet because their articles are posted. So we've never really gotten the truth about who the people were, at least who many of the people were, in the 9/11 attack. Could something like that be happening here? I just don't know. What are your thoughts?
It's true, and I don't think that we ever come to a very good, conclusive answer about these kind of attacks. At least I was never satisfied with the version of what supposedly happened in 9/11 and who the attackers were and how it happened, and certainly not enough to justify the reactions of the Bush administration. But let's take kind of a look at what's going on here with these terrorist attacks, and compare it with what I consider true terrorist attacks in other countries such as Israel. One of the effects that happens in Israel is that there are a lot of small scale attacks. We see news of these attacks a lot. I mean, an attack like this in London that happens, you know, at least monthly in Israel with four major bombs going off and 50 people killed happens quite easily down in Israel and happens all of the time. And what it does is the intent of that terrorism, or at least the result that we can observe, is that it creates less confidence among the people in government itself. It causes them to sort of not be confident, to distrust the amount of protection that government is offering, and that's really what the intent of terrorism is to foment internal turmoil among it. Contrast that now with what's happening with these very sporadic, large scale, very noteworthy attacks that have happened in the past couple of years with 9/11 and these bombings in London, is that every time it's a large scale attack, first of all, it doesn't happen very often, which is very suspicious given the complete lack of security. If you compare the amount of security that we have in the United States and in Europe and in the UK about stopping terrorists, compared with the amount that goes on in Israel, it's basically free. I mean, it's amazing that with supposedly the amount of terrorist network that is supposedly in place and which could very easily be in place, that we don't have small-scale attacks, multiple of them. I mean, here in the United States, it could happen all over the place, easily. Car bombings could take place in crowded places, at football stadiums and big group gatherings, and yet we see none of this, nothing.
That just goes to show you how effective our intelligence agencies really are. I think they know who all the terrorists are, and I think the terrorists know that they know who they are. And I think that they'd be afraid to do that sort of thing here because they know they'd be picked up immediately. But, you know, supposedly these people are so fanatical, they're quite willing to kill themselves. So why haven't we had more suicide bombings here in the United States? And maybe nothing as it appears to be. Would that be a fair statement?
Either that, Or the terrorists are funded or in league and to a certain extent controlled or majorly influenced by the government of the United States to the point that they can control when and how large of attacks they occur to be able to give a controlled response to induce certain actions from the general population.
We're going to be back here in just a moment here with Andrew Skousen talking about the London bombing. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon or this evening, Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And what is really so interesting is that certainly Tony Blair and President Bush had sagging popularity immediately before the London bombing. President Bush was down to about 42% approval rate. I don't know what Tony Blair was, but he had a major defeat during the last elections, and the Labour Party lost a considerable part of their strength. And yet, after this bombing, the popularity of both men, we're told, went up. At least Tony Blair's popularity went up, and more people, I think, were saying, well, see, obviously President Bush is right. Why, we've got to fight these terrorists, and far better to fight them on the streets of Baghdad than on the streets of New York. So would you agree with that?
Well, I think that one of the major differences between the effects of a terrorist attack in the United States and in the western part of the world versus what happens in Israel is that it foments greater confidence in our current leaders and encourages popular support for them. When they're large scale, people shrink in fear and say, well, save us, and cry to them. Whereas in Israel, I think appropriately see a terrorist attack as being a failure of the government to protect them, and consequently try to find a new solution to it. I think that the biggest indication that high scale terrorist attacks are used to create a certain direction in politics was during the Spain bombing. There was an immediate reaction at the polls with a major change in the government toward a very socialistic change.
You're speaking now, of course, the Madrid bombing. Of course, there was an election coming up just a couple of days after that, and of course, the government immediately attributed the bombing to the Basques, which you might think they're a group there that's been in revolt against the Spanish government for many years, and then it turned out it was really a terrorist, or at least we're told it was a terrorist attack, and that tended then to totally discredit the government, and they threw out the current government and they put in a socialist government, and of course it really changed the whole direction of Spain. That one terrorist attack changed the entire thrust of Spanish foreign policy.
That's right, and so the media spin after a major terrorist attack can have a major influence about this. The result of the Madrid bombings was, oh, well, this is in retaliation for our being part of the war in Iraq, and hence the change in government there. During the London bombings, it was attributed to, well, this is an attack on our leaders because of the G8 summit, which I think was a major stretch, since the G8 summit was in a completely different city. But they also attributed to, well, it's because we just got the Olympic nomination, and so they're fighting against our culture, and therefore we have to band together and fight it. And nothing was said about, oh, well, this is because this is of our involvement with the war in Iraq, which I think would have galvanized support in the opposite direction.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and we're talking about really how different it is with the terrorist attacks in Israel, which seem to be destroying the people's faith in their government. They're not offering security. And, of course, what happened in Great Britain, when, of course, this has really increased dramatically, Tony Blair's popularity, sagging popularity, now begins to rise. And even President Bush's popularity, down to 42%, has taken a jump upwards because, of course, of the fact of this terrorist bombing, and we've got to get behind our president. attempt to protest us.
That's right. Major terrorist attacks, I'm convinced, only cause people to herd themselves into complying more with government constrictions on liberty.
Right.
Small-scale terrorist attacks that are cheap and easy foster a fear about government's inability to stop them. But big attacks give government an excuse to surveil their citizens further. There's already talk about providing more and more screening of even the basic city's transportation system going on in London, and we'll probably see some kind of screening which will take place, which would of course be a huge hassle given the huge number of people and the very large network of public transportation that is involved with London's transportation system.
And of course, what they're doing is using the threat of terrorism to take away the freedom of the people in London and here in the United States.
That's right. Anything with increased screening leads to more information about more people. We've seen this now. Nobody can fly anywhere in the States now without being logged into the system and being tracked with wherever they go there. And it's just an incremental step, and that's what big terrorist attacks do. Small-scale terrorist attacks do the opposite. So the big question is really, why don't small terrorist attacks occur here? And I'm convinced that it's because there's collusion. I believe that there's government infiltration of all, if not most, of the major terrorist networks that provide funding to them and therefore keep them on a leash to do what they want. And I think that a good deal of what happens foments a certain amount of hatred towards the United States and is meant to foment that hatred to encourage these groups to stay alive and prosper, and it's all working very well.
And I think
look at the results.
I think an analogy would be the fact that we had infiltrated the communist movement here in the United States. We were financing the communist movement. The militia movement here in America was thoroughly infiltrated and largely funded by the FBI. We had infiltrated the mafia. We knew everything the mafia was doing, and eventually put all the major dons in prison. If we could do that, why would anybody think we would be incapable of infiltrating the Islamic movement here in the United States? And I would like to suggest we have infiltrated the Islamic movement here in the United States and throughout the rest of the world with the help of intelligence agencies throughout the world. In fact, at least 10 of them had told us the attack on 9/11 was coming here in the United States. And we totally ignored that. In fact, many of them even talked about airplanes attacking the World Trade Center. And you know, the most amazing thing is why the FBI refused to even consider that as a possibility.
Yeah, at least openly. That's right. I think that there are two levels to the infiltration. There's the true sort of spy infiltrators who are true patriots. Who really think that they're doing the right thing and are honestly there to try to protect people, as we've seen with some of the whistleblowers, particularly some of the whistleblowers that have come forward talking about government foreknowledge of the 9/11 attack, like you just mentioned. But I think that there's a second side, and I think that is sort of agent provocateurs. Governments often employ, or historically have always employed, agent provocateurs, which are also infiltrators, but they're meant to foment the groups and to encourage them in certain directions and in certain amounts to foment certain reactions from the general population.
And we've actually seen several examples of that in recent months where, government agents went to Muslims and were talking about doing all sorts of terrorist activities, and sometimes the fellows weren't even interested in it, but they talked them into making incriminating statements, and then, of course, they're recording the conversation. And if we really have such a great threat from this Islamic terrorist movement in America, why do they have to entrap people into making incriminating statements? or maybe nothing as it appears to be. We'll be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen. Andrew, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story?
All right. Well, we were talking a little bit about some of the inconsistencies with the story thus far about the bombings that occurred in London this past week. And I think an interesting clue that we have so far is that there was a certain amount of foreknowledge on the part of the police force in London. They were, of course, initially very shocked and acted very surprised about what happened and said that they had no warning about it. And that may very well be true for most of the common police and certainly for the common man. But what about some of the other officials? It's very interesting to keep track when a major event happens, because I think that the initial news sources that come out are some of the most accurate at the time. I don't think that there's really been time for the networks to get together and decide how they're going to spin the story, how it's meant to go, and so some of the initial press that comes out is sometimes some of the most accurate, because they're just grasping for any bit of evidence, and almost all of the evidence that is initially there seems to come out. The Associated Press reported that just before the blast, Scotland Yard, mind you, called the security officer at the Israeli embassy to say that they had received warnings of possible attacks. The official said, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the current finance minister for Israel, who had planned to attend an economic conference in a hotel that happened to be just over the subway stop where one of the blasts occurred, had received this warning through the warning to the Israeli embassy, and that prompted him to stay in his hotel room. So this is sort of a clue that there was foreknowledge. How much foreknowledge is not clear, but it seems to indicate that somebody knew enough to put two and two together about even where the explosion was going to take place and what the result of that would be, possible damage to the finance minister of Israel, which I don't think was planned as part of this attack. And, I mean, how much we can infer from this, I'm not positive, but...
Well, you hold that thought right there, Andrew. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring our other stations back on board here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and Andrew is talking about, was there foreknowledge of the attack? Now, of course, the average person wasn't told, but there were stories immediately after the attack that Benjamin Netanyahu, the finance minister of Israel, was warned of the attack shortly beforehand and was told not to go where he was going to be speaking, because he was going to be speaking in a hotel that was just over the subway where one of the bombs went off. Now, subsequently, the reports have come out and said, oh, Netanyahu wasn't notified ahead of time. There's no truth to this story. But the initial stories came in, and they were very, very clear that Netanyahu was advised ahead of time. And so what they're doing is you get one story, and then you get another story. But which one do you believe? Well, I think Andrew probably tends to put more truck in the initial story before the disinformation comes out. And they try, of course, to keep the people in America and in England from knowing that somebody knew the attack was going to come. Would that be a fair statement, Andrew?
I do. I absolutely agree with that. I think that just as first impressions are often the best, I think that when news agencies are searching for updated news and up to the minute things, they don't necessarily have time when a major event occurs to filter out the news as much, and consequently I think that the first news stories that come out are always the most accurate from what I've seen so far. I think that's true about the 9/11 situation. I think that's true about every major story that has come out. And in this case, even this story about foreknowledge hit the Associated Press, and that was that they had that Scotland Yard had warned the Israeli embassy that there was a possible attack, and coincidentally, possibly, that just happened to avoid that Benjamin Netanyahu avoided going to a hotel that was directly above one of the bombs. Happenstance, very unlikely, and if it's unlikely, it means that not only was there a hint of foreknowledge about bombing, but the fact that they only warned, as far as we know, the Israeli embassy about this means that they probably knew where, or very close to the approximate location of where these bombings were going to take place. So we can infer a little bit about this, which is that they for sure had foreknowledge of it, or a lot about this, and that is that they had in-depth foreknowledge about where this was going to occur and when. In either case, it's fairly damning to the source there that they didn't inform the rest of the basic police force and the Transportation Administration there about these dangers.
Well, of course, this is so very, very similar to 911, when, of course, we know that Mayor Willie Brown was notified the night before that he should be very careful flying on September 11th. Now, what was really so interesting about that is somebody pulled that article. It appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle in the morning edition. Somebody pulled that article out of all the subsequent editions of the San Francisco Chronicle of that day and either took it down off the Internet or prevented the story from getting up on the Internet. Who has the ability to do that, to manage the news to that extent? And if there is nothing to conceal, then why did they conceal it? Because they did. We have the article. We verified it by talking to Willie Brown's press secretary. We know it was true. So it seems like deja vu all over again. The stories of Netanyahu getting notification ahead of time. He should be careful. They're thinking about bombing that coming that morning. And, of course, you would expect them to deny it. But the report initially came out, and now they're doing everything they can to cover their tracks. Obviously, this is every earmark of an intelligence operation.
That's right. And, in fact, that's one of the most effective ways of making a story become quiet, is to make it unavailable to as many people as possible, and then to either downplay it in the news or give it a brief mention and then stop talking about it. And once mum's the word, nobody thinks that it's a big issue, and it's pretty hard to fight that. I mean, if the major press isn't talking about it, nobody seems to care. So it's a very effective technique of quieting stories, to take them off the air, which takes quite a bit of clout, like you mentioned, and then to influence all the rest of the major media not to carry that story and not to ask more questions about it and not to bring it up, which we all know would increase their ratings if they did talk about these blockbuster stories. And so it's not just the companies cutting it from the list of stories because it's not interesting. These are blockbuster stories that are being sidelined to hush up things that they don't want talked about.
Amen to that, and I think it's so important that we understand that there is a conscious effort to confuse the American people and to withhold information from them, and if this is going on, then I don't believe any man's life or property or family are safe.
That's right. With this kind of effect that the media can have on any story. I mean, there are constantly huge stories about people suffering great injustices all of the time that constantly get downplayed in the press, and we don't hear about them. And yet some small stories will make it to headline news and make it all over the country when they don't affect a particular policy or aren't dangerous to some agenda that's going on in government. And once you start to see these different news stories in the news and ask why one got put on the front page and not another, you start to see a lot of agenda in what the media is trying to portray.
Amen to that.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I'd like to talk about a different topic here. I think it goes right along with what we're saying. This is a story about a mother of a deceased soldier in the war on Iraq who was asked by the Bush administration to come up to his office as sort of a press interview to improve the president's image, to show him as being sympathetic to all of these people who have suffered losses in the war on Iraq. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the things that she had to say after this.
Now, this is the mother who actually went to the White House to be interviewed to meet the president, right?
Yes, right. The Bush administration often invites selected parents to the White House so that President Bush can meet them, and then they are really just used as props to rally support for the war. And this tactic is just beginning to backfire right now, because parents more and more are coming away with a bad feeling by the way they're treated by the president there. One person who lost a son in Baghdad in April of 2004 was invited to meet with President Bush and met with him two months or so after her son died. And she expected compassion and kind words, and the president instead acted very arrogantly, she said, without the slightest bit of compassion, she said. He walked in and said with a loud Texas accent, of course, he said, quote, "Who are we all honoring here today?" Instead of actually going to the extent of even knowing the name of the person that he was supposedly consoling the parents for. And so, in the end, I guess the extent of the story that I wanted to mention was that the press is manipulated easily as much as everyone fears, and sometimes blatantly so, such as in this case.
Well, I think we have managed news. We hear what they want us to hear. We see what they want us to see. We read what they want us to read. They create our reality. And when you understand that the media in the United States is controlled by five mega corporations, that would be, of course, Disney, Fox, Viacom, Bertelsmann, and Time Warner. Five mega corporations dominate the media in the United States. And the news today is totally managed. You are not getting the truth on most things. Lots of times you may think you're getting the controversy, but you get the controversy they want you to hear, not the true controversy, and not getting the actual facts out about what's really going on behind the scenes. A perfect example would be there's a major war going on in the Congo today. 3.5 million human beings have been killed there. There's been stories about the United Nations troops going in and raping the women there, and of course, giving the women the AIDS, and hardly any coverage of this in the major American media. They just totally ignore the suffering of the people in the Congo, and they go on to other important things like Michael Jackson or Lacey Peterson or Kobe Bryant or all of these other issues, but we do not cover the major issues really dealing with what's going on in the world today. And so many of the issues dealing with 9/11 are never mentioned. So many of the issues dealing with what's going on over in Iraq are never mentioned. we get what they want us to hear. As it's said in war, the first casualty is truth.
It's absolutely true. One of the stories in this week's brief actually talks specifically about a perfect instance of that. There was a another execution that a blatant execution by one of a group of the U.S. military in Iraq that occurred, and one of the only reasons that it actually received press coverage is because the relative of the victim happened to be rather powerful, and there was a report that this is a relative of Iraq's ambassador to the UN happened to be the victim in this case, and this was a 21-year-old boy who had studied engineering, in fact, and when the soldiers knocked on his door in Iraq, he happily opened it to try to practice his English. The soldiers asked if there were any weapons in the house, and he asked them to come in, took them into the back room where he showed them where there was an old hunting rifle, and so he took them to the back room. There was no live ammunition with the rifle. This was the last time that the family saw him alive. They ordered the family to wait outside, and as the Marines left, the interpreter that they brought with them told the mother that they had killed the boy, and he was found dead. A single bullet in the back of his neck. His cousin had been beaten, and it's a terrible story that we never hear about.
Well, I think the thing is that I think most of our soldiers are going to act responsibly. That there will always be bad people in any group.
That's right.
And when these things happen, that should be pointed out. These people should be arrested and tried and really, if they killed a man in cold blood, they should go to prison for life. What we're seeing is time and time again, Iraqis are being killed and little or anything is done to the wicked people who are doing it. Most of our troops are going to act responsibly because most of them are pretty good kids. But there
That's
will
right.
always be psychopaths. In fact, the military many times actually attracts that sort of person, one who enjoys killing. But we have to understand that war brings out the absolute worst in people. And as General Sherman had said so well during the Civil War, you know, war is brutality. War is cruelty. You can't make it any different. War is hell.
Yes, Sherman definitely was a good example of that, causing a lot of hell through his rampage. And it's certainly true that, and I know that during war there's a great deal that happens that isn't necessarily good on either side, no matter which side is fighting, that things will happen. It is a shame that sometimes politics even gets in the way of soldiers carrying out their duty because it looks so brutal on camera. But I think that some cases like this are certainly cases that the soldiers should be disciplined about this kind of actions, which I think you agree with.
Oh, I certainly do, and I think that something happened in my life. I think it was criminal to let Lieutenant Callie go, and yet most Americans wanted him to get after my life. If you know what really happened there, why, he should have been executed for what happened. That's what many of the people under his command for obeying orders that were immoral. But of course,
that's right, and I think that the military is more and more attracting lower quality of people to its ranks, especially with the unpopularity of knowing that you're very likely going to have to serve abroad in these kinds of war. It discourages people who can make a living elsewhere to do so and not sign up for the ring.
And that's why they're going to have the draft. They know they're going to have the draft. And they're lying to the American people when they're saying we're not planning on having it, because they're actually, the Pentagon has hired a corporation to begin collecting dossiers on everybody, I think, from about 35 down to 18. And they're getting all the information on your sons and on your daughters, too, in preparation to send them off to die.
That's right. I think that that's an interesting point, Dr. Stan. I think if there is a draft, I don't think it'll be just the male this time. I think that the military has expanded to the point where they found a use for females as well, and the draft may very well include both.
And I think we live in a world gone mad. There's no instance in all history where, they sent women into battle. They tried it in Russia during the Second World War.
That's
and
right.
The Russians gave up the idea. They tried it in Israel, and Israel rejected it. And what are we doing? Well, we're doing exactly what both of those countries tried and found it failed. But, of course, if you wanted to destroy our military, why, you destroy their faith in God, you would promote homosexuality and put homosexuals into command positions, you would have women in combat, totally demoralize the military. They're doing a great job. Well, Andrew, we've got 3 more minutes. Why don't you pick up the story from there?
All right. Well, one of the stories that I was hoping to touch on today has to do with the new Supreme Court nominee. I think that there were some very cogent remarks made by Representative Ron Paul. I think that Ron Paul is one of the only truest patriots that we have in Congress today, and he mentions that it is folly to believe we will regain lost freedoms if only the right individuals are appointed to the Supreme Court. Republican presidents, including conservative icon Ronald Reagan, have appointed some of our very worst Supreme Court judges. In today's political context, it frankly matters very little whom President Bush appoints to replace Justice O'Connor. Even the most promising jurists can change radically over the course of a lifetime appointment. We are supposed to be a nation of laws, not men, and the fixation on individuals as saviors of our freedoms is misplaced. America will regain lost freedoms only when her citizens wake up and reclaim a national sense of self-reliance, individualism, and limited government. A handful of judges cannot save a nation from itself. As you know, Dr. Stan, President Bush has always said when he was campaigning that if he got in, that he would change that he would only appoint principled people to the Supreme Court, that we would finally get more pro-life people in there. If we examine the current nominee that he is trying to fight to get in, who is Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, this will be the first Hispanic, which is, of course, one of the major reasons that President Bush is pushing it to be politically correct, but Gonzalez is not pro-life. He has a very dubious record on conservative issues in general, and I think that a lot of the conservatives are concerned about him and have good reason to be so. So I think that we're going to see here probably Gonzalez reach the appointee position and President Bush will follow a long line of conservative presidents who appoint a very unconservative or someone who will swing vote on conservative issues a great deal of the time, just as O'Connor was notorious for doing.
And because I think my real concern is that we consider these people conservative because we're told they are, but are they really?
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I'm going to have to let you go, Andrew. But let's go ahead and get your telephone number and your website out so people would know how to get in touch with the World Affairs Brief.
Yes. They can go to the website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com, and there are stories there that they can click on. They can read the first story of every weekly brief, and they can click on a link which will take them to a place where they can log on and download, arrange to receive the World Affairs Brief by email. They can also receive it by print if they wish. They can call toll-free area code 1-877-581-5888. That's area code toll-free, 1-877-581-5888.
All right, well, thank you so very much, Andrew. We'll look forward to having you on again next week or so, and I appreciate everything you're doing, and certainly I go to World Affairs Brief every morning just to read the articles that Andrew and his brother and the rest of the team there have pulled down for me. Saves me a lot of time on the Internet and puts you right on the cutting edge of what's going on. Again, the website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. Good night. God bless, Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, for everything you do.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the point I just want to mention, that we have an opportunity to triple the listening audience of this program. We, for the first hour of the program, we actually have about 12 stations that pull it down, and there are a number of other stations that are pulling it down as well, and micro stations. We have a chance to increase that number to 30. But, of course, it's going to be somewhat expensive. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you agree that there's a problem and you agree with me that the only way we have of reaching people is by radio, if you'd like to help us and make a pledge to help us over the coming months so that we would be able to do that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and let us know if you can help us as we begin to reach out in an organized manner to pick up, 18 more stations. So if we can do that, we'll begin to increase our coverage, and we're working constantly to try to get more and more people listening, mainly so they can get educated, so they can understand the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged, because this truly is a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And you can listen to our programs there directly or on the links that we have 5 hours a day on the Internet and not get much accomplished. You can hear us 5 hours a day on satellite, 5 hours a day somewhere in America on radio, and then 4 hours a day on shortwave. Your job is, of course, to tell other people about our program. Your job is to download our newsletters. There's a tremendous amount of great information in those newsletters. I agonize over them every month, but when, of course, we complete them, they're unlike anything you'll read elsewhere. Our latest newsletter, June newsletter, will be going out in the next couple of days. It is the Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And you're going to read things there that will make you say, could this really be true? Is there really another dimension? Are there really spiritual forces that are energizing the people in positions of leadership? And I would like to suggest that this is nothing new. It's always been there. As you begin studying the history of our country, you find these spiritual forces have been at work since the very inception of America, challenging the Christian heritage that gave us the freedom that we enjoy. Again, our webpage, radioliberty.com. If you'd like a free copy of our June newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, again, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because I'm convinced that America doesn't turn back to God. God will turn his back on America. Till tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.